Mr. Elliott, suppose we start out with something about your early background, where you were born, what kind of family you had.
Well, I was born in a little town out in western Nebraska, not Pat, Nebraska. That happened to be Buffalo Bill's home town, of course. That's where I initiated my contact with him. My dad was a blacksmith. He came from a line of blacksmiths in England. And he worked for the Union Pacific Railroad Company until the time of his retirement.
Oh, he did?
Mm-hmm. He died in 1932. He was 85, 86 years old. We lived in a typical western town. And you wouldn't believe some of the pictures I have of things that happened out there in the Indian country.
It was still pioneer country.
We were out in the pioneer country. I still remember the Indians, of course, and the cowboys.
How long did you live there?
I lived there from the time I was born until I left to go to school in 1906.
Well, it was a fair time then.
And then I went back and worked with the Union Pacific Railroad Company most of the summers.
Well, is this how you got interested in engineering? Because of your acquaintance with the railroad?
Well, I worked, I worked in the railroad shops, and I learned the machinist trade during the years in the summertime and off-time periods. Then when I got out of school, I worked for them in Omaha, Nebraska. I got out of school in 1910, and then I went to Alice Chalmers in Milwaukee. I worked for them for about 6-7 months. And I went back to Omaha to work for the Union Pacific Railroad Company. The interesting question I usually have is, why did I go way back to Indiana to go to school?
I was kind of kept to that.
Now, that's a very interesting situation. The day after I graduated from high school, the superintendent of motive power and machinery of the Union Pacific was graduated of the Rose Polytechnic Institute down in Indiana. He came to the shop where my dad worked and asked about what I was going to do. My dad told him that maybe they could arrange to send me down to the University of Nebraska. And this gentleman, the name of William R. McKean, said, "I got a proposition to make to you. If you can get into Rose Poly, I will give him round-trip transportation from North Platte to Terre Haute and back twice a year. I'll give him a job every summer. I'll give him a job when he gets out of school."
Oh my, you couldn't pass up an opportunity like that, could you?
And that's how I come to go back to this little school in Indiana.
Well, that's very interesting. Can we go back to a little bit about Cody?
Well, that's a long, won't get out here today if you get me started on that.
Well, I'd still like to know a little first-hand information.
Well, I, of course, as a small boy, I knew of the Cody situation at Platte, but I really wasn't old enough to appreciate it. The first time I really saw him to get a good impression of him was on the 13th of October, 1896, when he brought his Wild West show to his home ranch. And Sunday afternoon, my dad took me up. I think there were 4 trainloads of circus equipment and personnel which came in. My first impression of him, as he got off the Pullman car, and he had a double-breasted blue serge suit, and he took off his big hat and waved it in the air, and stepped down to the ground. That was my first impression, close-up impression of Cody, and I still remember it as it was yesterday. This was on Sunday afternoon. And for the next two or three days, we had a real, real exciting time in that little time in that little town. He went in and bought all the saloons, and there were a lot of them. I called them saloons in those days.
Bought them out.
Moved all the liquor, kegs, barrels out in the streets. Tied tin cups on the barrels and the kegs. Turned all the Indians and cowboys loose.
Oh my gracious.
And for 24 hours, we had a real exciting time.
I bet.
The interesting thing was on Sunday. And the first production of the show out at the ranch was on Monday. And in this little town of a little over 2,000 people, there were 30,000 people came to that production.
30,000?
30,000 people.
Where did they all come from?
All over western Nebraska. Of course, he was a sort of a hero to everybody in western Nebraska. And they came there and in great hordes. I remember that we ran out of food, and they sent a lot of wagons out to get in a lot of watermelons. Seemed to have been a good watermelon season, and so they brought in watermelons to feed the people.
Oh dear.
The attendants, I checked with his sister, and we were in disagreement about 4,000 or 5,000, but the town was just literally jammed with people. Of course, the way he had his playing field mapped out, he could expand it or contract it, whether he had 10,000 or 30,000. That was 1996. His show was pretty well along then. That was after he'd made his trip to Europe. Of course, being a little town, all the people knew each other. And when Cody took his show to Europe, to London, England, in 1986, I guess it was, my mother and father, my brothers happened to be over in England at that time.
Oh, so they saw it there?
Hmm?
They saw the show in England?
That's where they came from originally.
Oh, I see.
And my mother had a great time over there. Cody just treated him royally, and he gave her tickets and passes for all her English friends over there. They went down and ate with Cody in his tent regularly. They just had a glorious time with him over there. I guess that was the first trip he made with the Wild West to Europe. He had a basic idea that he picked up, that he wanted to provide a piece of educational machinery to show the people what Western Nebraska, Western United States, really was. And he probably was one of the best public relations people the United States ever had.
Well, there were a lot of misconceptions about what the West was like still at that time, weren't there?
When I started looking up all this material as a hobby, I ran into something which other people have run into. We could find no authentic source material which we could depend upon. And when Professor John Hicks was here in American History, I talked to him about it. And he told me that when he was at the University of Nebraska, he assigned a couple of graduate students the task of looking into a lot of this, trying to find some authentic source material on the Cody legends and lores. And he said they were just up against the stone wall. So he was the victim of one of the first press agents. And they got him to the point where he really didn't know what to believe. And consequently, a lot of the material that has been published about Cody is just pure myths, imagination. You remember the series of dime novels which came out about Cody?
Oh, yes.
They're real prize now. You can hardly acquire any of them. But that's one of the handicaps in getting any authentic source material on Cody.
What a shame.
But and, there are a lot of very, very interesting things in the Cody story that would take hours and hours and hours to tell. I was over at the Triangle Fraternity House one night when we got talking about this. I mentioned the Dragon's Blood divorce case, which practically nobody knew anything about.
I've never heard of it.
Well, some of the boys, one of the boys over there is on the Wisconsin engineer. So he got interested in it. Well, I gave him the results of some of my experiences in looking up this material. So he prepared an article for the Wisconsin engineer, which I don't know what particular January it came out, but there's a real interesting story called Dragon's Blood. That in itself is a very interesting story. I knew about it because I was a boy then, and I knew the newspapers. And story goes that he applied for a divorce from Mrs. Cody. I knew them both. And at the trial, he claimed that she tried to poison him. I was just a boy around town then, but I read the newspapers. And at the trial, she testified that it was dragon's blood that she got from the gypsy fortune teller. And she gave him to sort of redirect his affections from her or from some of these actresses to him. Well, the whole thing was squelched because it was a part of a controversy going on between the two Denver newspapers. So sometime later, I went out to after I came here and started to write up the Cody story. I went out to Denver, asked if they'd let me see their files for the time the trial was going on. Well, I will say they just threw me out gently, that's all.
Oh, dear.
And told me if I wanted to see any of that material, I better get down to the Denver Public Library. Well, I went down there and they just threw me out a little more gently than they did up the newspaper's office, so I didn't get to see any of it. Well, when I got back, I was telling Frank Thayer over in the School of Journalism about it. He said, well, the next time I go to Denver, he said, I got a pull out there with those people. I will go in and see if I can get it for you. Well, in the meantime, he died.
That possibility.
But Arthur Sears Henning in the Chicago Tribune got wind of this.
Who?
Arthur Sears Henning. He was quite a noted writer for the Chicago Tribune. He got wind of this. So he went out to Denver and he dug up all of this material and he published quite an interesting article in the Chicago Tribune. And I turned most of this article over to the boys in the Wisconsin engineer when they wrote up the story. But the thing that amazes me is that some movie company hasn't gotten out a movie on this Dragon's Blood divorce case. I happen to know the attorneys on both sides, Mrs. Cody's attorney and Lofa Bill's attorney, and so that gave me an added interest in it.
Oh, I would think.
But that was a great mistake he made. Well, when he lost the case.
Oh, he did lose
it. He lost the case. Well, Mrs. Cody's attorneys were a couple of high-quality lawyers out in Western Nebraska, just at the peak of their profession, and they just licked the tail off of Cody. This lawyer, who was a friend of mine, too, afterwards ran for governor of Wyoming.
Oh.
But that whole story is quite interesting. I'm working up the details of it, this presentation to the Civil War Roundtable.
Oh, I bet.
Now, in practically no book which would come out on Cody do you find any reference to this Dragon's Blood divorce case. But Arthur Sears Henning picked it up.
Well, maybe the other people had as much trouble getting information as you did.
I was interested in it. Well, an interesting thing about these writers, the fact that Cody's been dead for 65 years now. And every week, a book or a magazine article is coming out about Cody. Well, there was a editor of an encyclopedia that made up his mind he was going to write a real honest-to-goodness book about Cody. But I noticed in practically every statement he makes, he said it had been reported that so-and-so said this about Cody. Well, within the last year, one of the old-time writers in Western Nebraska prepared a book on Cody. And she had one chapter about myths concerning Cody. And she sort of knocks in the head a lot of these stories which have been told about him. Well, on this Sunday following this, bringing the show back to the Cody Ranch, we had, Cody used to call up all the ministers in town. That was a habit he had. And ask them two questions. Did you get any pay last year? Some of them didn't get very much. Does your church have any financial obligations? And if Cody thought they didn't get enough, he'd send them a check. The difference. So he gave lots and lots of money away, particularly to the churches. But they wouldn't let him into a church in a bet. He used to heckle a preacher.
Oh, he did?
I saw one or two interesting things that next day, that same Sunday. I saw Cody pull up his horse and plunge right through the plate glass front of a saloon out there and get the horse back of the barn, and he took out his gun and knocked all of the bottles, whiskey to pieces. But with our 29 saloons and all these Indians and cowboys, we had a really, really good time.
Oh, dear.
It's a very interesting story. It'll just take hours and hours and hours. Have you seen the book that the Historical Society got out?
No, as a matter of fact, I haven't.
National Geographic had an article in Cody about this 3 or 4 months.
Oh my. Well, I hadn't seen that.
There's historical material on this.
Now, who put this out?
Historical Society.
Here?
In Madison.
Wonderful posters.
See, that's, I said it was 86, but I guess it was 87 when they took their show over there. Well, I happened to be up at, I saw both Mrs. Cody and Mr. Cody shortly before he died. It was either in Denver, North Platte, where I saw them. Buffalo Cow and Buffalo Bill, they used to call them.
Oh, Buffalo Cow and Buffalo Bill, I never heard the cow part.
there's a great variety, but here's a little publication which an editor of a Denver newspaper got out about Cody. This is for school kids. Rather interesting. Well, it was Cody's playing ground out there, and the kids ought to know about him.
Oh, I think so. How do you explain this continuing interest that you've described?
Well, within the past week or 10 days, one of the national magazines made a survey of heroes of this country. They picked out 8 of them. One of them was Cody. There was just a thrill to the people who saw the Cody Wild West that just permeated that whole area out there. I think there's a letting up of the interest in Cody now on the part of the new generation, the older generation out there still knowing. Everybody about Mrs. Cody, well, I had several conflicts with her. One particular one I remember distinctly was we were having a city election in this little town, and I was asked to drive a buggy with two horses around to pick up all the voters and take them down to the voting booth. Well, they gave me the list, and I got them all down, and I was down to two that I didn't have. One was the town drunk, and the other was Mrs. Cody's gardener. Well, I got the drunk all right. Then I went up to the old Cody, the Cody residence in North Platte, which is rather an ornate building. It's torn down now. And I found this gardener under a tree. He was doing something with some plants out there. He knew me because he was mad at me. Because the kids had organized a circus, and we picked out his boy to be a snake charmer. And he didn't get along very well with the snake, and the snake took a bit out of his wrist. So he didn't give me much encouragement about going down to vote. Well, I said, Bruno, we said, if I go down to vote, Mrs. Cody will fire me. I said, well, I'll go and ask her, Bruno. So I went up and knocked on the door, and much to my surprise, she came to the door. And I told her what she wanted, and she slammed the door, and that was all there was to it. Well, I went back, and Bruno said, what did she say? Well, I said, Bruno, she said I could take you down to vote.
Oh, you didn't.
I took him down the vault and brought him back, and she never knew the difference.
I see.
But there's just no end to this Cody lore. I get started, and I'll never stop.
Well, maybe we should get back to some of these other topics that we have to... But the Cody thing is pretty fascinating. I don't know.
Well, he was a remarkable individual. He was considered to be sort of a drunkard and that sort of thing. But when you go back and study the conditions under which he lived, he was born down in Iowa, and he moved on to western Missouri, which was the beginning of the Oregon Trail. And he came in contact there, and he lived with the boy. He lived down there in this rough country. I went down and spent a day at Weston. I got a hold of an old Indian who told me a great deal about the Cody family when they were down there. And, of course, his father instigated the abolition movement on slavery. And that was the reason that he had so much trouble. And that's the first time Cody ever saw a Negro when he went down to Weston. He lived a pretty rough life down there. So when you consider the environment and the conditions under it, see, he couldn't read and write. The conditions under which he lived, he turned out pretty well.
It seems so.
He turned out pretty well. Well, he met a lot of... One of the people who had a great influence with him was Wild Bill Hickok, who looked after Cody when he was a boy on the trucking company that ran along the Oregon Trail clear to the Pacific Coast, which was a huge enterprise, thousands and thousands of oxen and wagons and cowboys. And that's where Cody got his first taste of being a Pony Express rider. Just that one story of his experiences riding the Pony Express was enough for the whole story in itself.
I can imagine that.
I'm just noticing the other day that he made one trip of 322 miles on 20 horses, carrying some messages to the West. He had a hatred of mules, and his... The stories that you can find about his contact with mules really amusing, really funny. A lot of funny things.
Well, mules are a little different from horses.
Now we're getting a little off the...
Yes. Well, let's get back. Did it seem quite natural to you to in the light of your early family background and your father's association with the railroad and so forth, for you to be interested in railroads and mechanical things?
Yes, that's right. When Jim Woodward was alive, he and I used to gallivant around the state watching all the trains go by, and so he and I were interested in railroads from the very beginning. I still am.
Well, it's interesting that you've known them for such a long time, because they've changed so much.
Oh, they surely have. They surely have. I was at a meeting the other day with this chap out here at the First Relay Company. What's his name that sponsors these weather reports in the morning? Well, he's a railroad buff. He spends most of his time talking about railroads.
Well, so is the director of the archives, Frank Cook.
Oh, is
he's
he?
A railroad buff. He collects timetables and all sorts of material on railroading.
Well, I worked for the railroad at a time when we were trying to build what is now the diesel locomotive. Of course, I got out of the railroad business before it was really developed, but that's another interesting story, the development of that that particular unit.
Well, go ahead.
Oh, it would take hours to tell about that.
Would it take too long?
Well, these are rather interesting units. They were built as, to run very much like our buses, although they ran on the railroad tracks. We built them in Omaha in the railroad shops, and then we sent them out into the... So we sold them to railroads all over the country. And I had a job of taking them out and delivering these cars and putting them into service. That was quite a thrilling.
You ran these engines? Well, that was an interesting experience. No wonder you were interested in all of this.
I remember down in Fort Worth one night. It was Fort Worth. We got run into it. We had 92 people in the car. And we got run into the passenger train. And
what happened?
We didn't kill anybody. We didn't hurt anybody. It was due to the fact that the driver, the man we were breaking in to run this car, came around the curve going into Fort Worth and he saw a horse in the track. And he didn't know what to do. So he ran into the horse, and that stopped us, and the passenger train came along and ran into us.
Oh, I see. Oh, goodness. Well, getting back to your education, I understand that you got your master's here at the University of Wisconsin.
No, I got my master's degree down at Rose Poly.
Oh, you did?
Mm-hmm.
Well, then I'm misinformed. when did you come to the university?
The first day of September, 1912.
I see.
And at that time, Dean Knorr, who was dean of the College of Engineering, was in Europe. And John G. D. Mack, who was in this department, was acting dean the first year I was here. And he assigned me to Professor H. J. Tarkelson. You remember who he was. He's our business manager for a long time. And we worked on a number of interesting things that first year. He had us develop and prepare what is known as a Mollier diagram, which came into quite extensive use in making power plant calculations. So we made one of the first Mollier diagrams. It involved this thousands of calculations, and we had to put it in map size. I worked with a chap named Bergman, Alexander Bergman.
I'm going to have to stop for a minute. Here.
Well, I worked in the diagram, and I worked in the steam and gas laboratory over at the. That's where I first got my contact with the Extension Division. Louis Reber, who was dean of the Extension Division, apparently asked John Mack if he had anybody who could go out and handle an extension class in internal combustion engine. Well, John Mack knew him, the experience I'd had, so I did some work for the Extension Division on internal combustion engines. I had a class in Janesville and went on Beloit, and afterwards had one up at the state prison.
What were they doing at the state prison? Just learning?
See, the internal combustion engine was something fairly new then. And everybody wanted to learn all about the intricacies of the internal combustion engine. So the class they organized at the prison was made up pretty largely of young people who had been up there. And I got to know some of them pretty well. I had a funny experience with that group. I was down in the Union Station in Chicago one afternoon waiting for the train to come back to Madison. Some chap came up and slapped me on the back, and I turned around and said, "Don't you remember me? We were in Waupun together." And then that's how I got my introduction to the Extension Division. I've had so much practical experience outside then that we worked in pretty well with Extension Division activities.
You're talking about an engineering extension, yes.
Well, I did a lot of work in Milwaukee, and after the war, they sent me over to Milwaukee to start I suppose you'd call it a branch of the university. We were in an old building down on Van Buren Street. We started courses in drawing and all the things that the people were interested in. That was the beginning of the Milwaukee Center.
Well, this was right after World War One.
World War One. I wasn't here during the war.
Well, what were you doing?
I was working for the United States Shipping Board. We were building freighters. And I first was sent down to Hog Island. That's a big shipyard down south of Philadelphia. And by the time we got the shipyard built, the war was over. But I worked at Hog Island, and they sent me out to the Great Lakes shipyards. We were particularly interested in training people, welders, riveters, ship carpenters, people who could work on these ships which they were building in the Great Lakes. See, they were limited in the Great Lakes because of the locks. You could get in, I think it was 268 was the length of the maximum length of a merchant ship that they could get through the lakes.
Oh.
I think I spent the longest time up at Manitowoc in their shipyard. They had one of the best shipyards in the country there.
How did you get from railroads and internal combustion engines to shipping?
Well, that's what I was told to do.
Well, who was the one telling you?
After Reber was dean of the Extension Division, and he was called to Washington to organize this training program for people in a great many industries, and I got assigned to the shipbuilding industry.
I see.
When I got on to Hog Island, I ran into Fisher Carl Thomas, who was in our College of Engineering for a long time. He's quite a musician.
Yes.
And I remember he used to complain, we had enough ship bells and fire equipment to last for 1,000 years, but it couldn't get any engines in the ships.
Oh, well, this was a problem. This would have been a problem.
Well, your question about the internal combustion engine, well, I got interested in that because we were trying to put an internal combustion engine into this unit we were building for the railroad company. I have some models around here somewhere, said the unit.
Well, now before that, of course, it was steam, wasn't it?
Hmm?
Before that, they were steam. Mm-hmm. What do you know about the beginnings of steam engines?
Well, I was almost brought up in a steam boiler. I think I have a picture here of a locomotive that I was on. Oh, but I worked in, I served my time in this locomotive shop where all of our motive power was steam. I had a lot of experience in the steam locomotive. When I was a small boy, I used to get out and ride with the engineers and the trains.
Oh, that must have been fun.
You know, they'd stick me up in the fireman's side of the cab, which was the left side. Told me to keep out of trouble. I've had ride after ride after ride in the cabs of the passenger locomotive.
Well, now, you were sufficiently interested in the internal combustion engine to write about it, I understand.
Well, yeah, I had wrote it. Well, at that time, there was a widespread interest in internal combustion engine due to its application to automobiles and tractors. But there was nothing available in the textbook line. So I talked to Dean Reber about it, and we went ahead then and prepared what turned out to be a textbook on the gasoline automobile. And it sort of clicked off pretty well. We ran through, I don't know how many editions of it, including one in Russian. Huh. Nearly 500,000 copies of that.
So it was used extensively?
All over, mm-hmm. Well, it just happened to fit in at the time in these vocational schools and technical schools. It wasn't designed for College of Engineering people at all, but it was used in a number of places. I don't think I have a copy of it here. I think there were, I don't know how many, I think there were 5 books total we got out. They all went pretty well.
Well, I read an amusing statement that was amusing to me about this by you, I believe, by somebody, made in about 1939, that the engine had gotten about as far as it was going to go in terms of development.
You mean the steam engine?
No, the internal combustion engine.
Well, there have been a few improvements, but not too many.
Well, that's why I was wondering how significant you think the recent developments have been.
Oh, you see, one of the difficulties that they ran into when they started to build them, they didn't have machine tools which were sufficiently accurate to turn out parts which were needed for the internal combustion engine. Now, on this big unit we built, the Union Pacific, it was a big engine. And we were trying to build engines with parts with an accuracy which was unknown in the railroad business. We just didn't have any any machine tools or people that were able to do that. And I spent weeks and weeks turning down cams to go in this big engine we had. Well, we did it almost, they were almost custom made. Well, you couldn't turn out those cams today and put them in an engine, they wouldn't work, it would go too crude. But that's just a part of the development of it. Then I got particularly interested in the diesel engine because one of my friends down in Fairbanks, Morris, used to work for diesel. And that's how I got interested in the diesel engine.
Well, of course, they put those in cars now.
Yes, they do. The great mistake we've made in this country, though, is letting our railroads go to pot.
Yes, that is great shame.
And we're going to realize that if we get into another military contest, we're going to miss them.
Well, of course, we've relied more and more on the trucking industry to do what the railroads used to do.
Well, they're limited in what they can do.
Yes, that's true.
Of course, the other countries haven't followed our pattern on locomotive. Their train service is pretty good in most of the European countries.
Yes, I understand. In fact, when I was there,
we used to have some of the top trains in the world. I remember when we used to have a contest out in the Nebraska and Iowa on carrying the mail. The mail contract was a cherished plum that they liked to get. So they used to run a contest from Chicago to Denver with the Burlington Railroad or the Union Pacific Railroad. And we used to watch that just the way we watch football games now. I had a ride in one of those trains. I remember I asked the engineer what his orders were. He said they were quite simple. Get to the other end just as fast as you can.
Well, no, I think it'd be simpler than that. Well, I have a fondness for trains because my father worked for the Chicago-Milwaukee Railroad.
Mm-hmm.
And
I just got a card from one of the former presidents of the Milwaukee Railroad Company.
Did
an
you?
Old gentleman living up in Watertown, New York, and he always sends me a card at Christmas time.
Oh, nice.
And on my birthday. He must be 100 years old now.
Gracious. Well, it is a pity about trains. Of course, the automobile has taken passenger service away. The automobile and the airplane has taken passenger service from the railroads.
I think they're going to press themselves out of the market.
You do.
I don't think there's any question about it. Now, how many people can spend $100 and some to get on to Chicago and back on an airplane?
Fewer and fewer.
Well, if you want to get out to the airport, that costs you nearly $5. And it's about $50 one way to Chicago, and it takes another $5 to get on to the loop. So that's $10 on top of the $100. That's $110 round trip to Chicago. You get on the bus and back for $25. I go to Milwaukee and take the train down.
Oh, you do?
Mm-hmm. I go take the Badger bus over to Milwaukee. Their station's only a few blocks in the railroad station. I walk over and take the turboliners down to Chicago.
Well, you used to be able to take the train from Madison to Chicago.
You could. Well, that's what this man Kiernan's kicking about, this really man. Of course, the trouble is they don't have the roadbed now to...
Well, they've let those go.
Yeah.
And that's a big problem. Even Amtrak is having troubles.
Oh, well, some of the railroads, Santa Fe, and the Burlington Northern, the Union Pacific, They've kept their roadbeds in apple pie order. Last time I was out to Western Nebraska and went out to see the Cody Park, I went over to their big reclassification yards. The director tells me that he sends out 45 passenger trains, or freight trains a day, with 100 cars each. And they travel at 75 and 85 miles an hour. So on the freight side of it, the railroads are still doing pretty good.
Well, that's encouraging. Not enough. I've been wondering a little bit if you tell me what the department was like when you first came.
Well, we were located in the building over at the Department of Education has now, right across the old law building. And we were set up for the departments of civil, mechanical, mining and metallurgy. We're in the old heating plant, which the radio station had for a time.
Oh, yes, yes, that small small building behind Science Hall.
Mm-hmm. There was a very interesting, in that old building, we used to have a meeting each year with the Engineers Society of Milwaukee. And we always used to have it in that building where they had facilities for cooking hot dogs and all that sort of thing that the fellows liked. That was when I think that's one of the first efforts we made to establish a good working relationship with industry.
It sounds as though your relationship with industry had not been very good.
Well, there just wasn't any at the beginning.
Well, why not?
And after I'd been in the Extension Division for a while, and I spent a part of my time just going out and visiting industry all over the state. I got to know a lot of people, which you have to in the extension activities. You got to know a lot of people.
Well, what was the problem that industry had? Why weren't they interested in what the university could do?
Well,
or in research?
They just weren't. Research hadn't been. There hadn't been too much research at that time. Most of what I ran into was just routine teaching activity. Some of the departments did a lot of research. Mechanics did a lot of it. Withy and people who preceded him. And I think one of the first was the mining and metallurgy department. They established some extension classes in Milwaukee. And that was one of the, that led to the initiation of a lot of these short courses we used to have in, we call them conferences, in Madison. We had a welding conference and, there were a lot of those activities we brought the people together from industry. That was something fairly new at that time.
So mostly what you were doing was teaching.
That's right. And I had a little advantage. I was quite active in the National Society of Mechanical Engineers, and that gave me contacts all over the United States. And then when I served three terms as National Vice President of ASME, which gave me an opportunity to visit most places in the United States. And I met a lot of fine people. Mm-hmm. I just noticed here, I guess it's home. You know who Mrs. Gilbreth was?
Well, I know she was a distinguished woman.
Yeah, we had her here for a semester.
I don't know much more than that about her.
They're going to have a postage stamp out for her now.
Oh, good. Now that's unusual, because when she was here, she was not a young woman.
Oh, no. Cheaper by the dozen.
Do you know how she got started? It's unusual for a woman to be
in that field. Oh, I know her very, very, very well. I met her one night in New York. She said, "Would you like to come over to our family party tonight?" And I think there were 27 of her family there.
My gracious.
Her father, her husband was a bricklayer, originally. And you saw the movie that they got out.
No, I didn't.
Cheaper by the Dozen?
No, I don't think I did. I'm familiar with it. I mean, I've heard of it.
Even when she was real, real well along in her years, I used to try to keep track of her. I was particularly anxious to get her, we were trying to get her here in, for a semester. I couldn't find her, and I called up her son. I think he was down in, I don't know where he was, someplace in the United States. He said, "Don't expect me to tell you where she is. She gallivants around the world, so I can't keep track of her. As far as I know today, she's down in Mexico City."
Well, do you know how she got into her field?
Well, I think it came from her school. She wasn't really an engineer. She was, I think, a psychologist more than anything else. I got a story down there I wrote about her.
I'd like to see that sometime.
And she developed quite a connection with Purdue. And of course, my brother was on Purdue then.
Well, he was president, wasn't he?
And so I got to know Mrs. Gilchrist very, very well.
Now, she did come for a semester, didn't she?
She was here for a semester. Mm-hmm.
What did she? Did she just give seminars? Did she teach?
No, largely. We had her over here in this building. That map there was one that she left when she. She left here when she. Oh, she said, "I can't stand those winters up there."
Well, she's got lots of company in that.
If you haven't read her book, Cheaper by the Dozen.
I haven't, should.
Just for curiosity, you ought to read it. It's
well, it's a very well-known title.
It is. She hated it. And she was upset when this movie came out.
Well, I can imagine.
Well, those are just one of the byproducts.
Well, you've told me a little bit about your facilities. Were they, or where you were they adequate for
the
your
time,
purposes?
For the time, they were. There wasn't too much research going on, a little, but not on the scale it is now. Of course, the reason was they didn't have the financial support.
What, if industry wasn't interested in extension or what the university could do, what made the change?
They were interested. Well, we hadn't sold it to them.
So it was publicity, partly?
One of my jobs that when I was doing that sort of thing, we used to go out and talk to these industries in their own backyard and ask them if there's anything we could do for them and offer to work with them. And I think that was the beginning of some of the financial grants we received from the university. And then we worked with the engineering societies in the state. Milwaukee had of course, the engineer said in Milwaukee was one of the outstanding in the country. A weekly report on each visit to each industry in the state. And that, I think, is where we broke the ice to get into these concerns and get them interested. And then as more and more engineering graduates got into these industries, the interest in the university, I think, increased tremendously.
Were the industries at that time doing very much research themselves?
Many of them were not doing very much. We would try to, if they had a specific problem, we'd try to talk them into giving us some money to start a project over here. which had a double value. It gave them some information and gave some of our graduate students an opportunity to do some work. Some of them proved to be very good and some of them didn't.
So it sounds as though this relationship built up slowly.
It came. I think it just increased as the importance of engineering and industry developed in the state. Of course, Milwaukee had some top-notch industries. I was challenged. I worked for them for a while.
Mm-hmm. Well, that was a center of industry, wasn't it? Wasn't that the largest area in the state?
I think that was the largest industry in the state. And there was the Nordberg refrigeration and the Presteel tank. Oh, there were just numbers of them. The Falk Company, which is still one of the big companies in Milwaukee. And we have a lot of industries around us in Beloit and Janesville, Fairbanks, Morse.
Well, we didn't so much then, did we?
No, well, Fairbanks Morse was there. They built diesel locomotives for quite a period of time. So we initiated that, and I think it turned out very well.
How long were you actively doing this extension work?
Oh, I worked for both places for quite a while. I don't exactly know how many months or years, but I worked for both the Extension Division and the University and the College of Engineering at the same time.
Must have been pretty busy with all this traveling.
Well, I had a meeting in New York one night. Next night I was in Portland, Oregon. Following morning I had to be back in Chicago.
Gracious. Well, tell me something about the College of Engineering when you came.
Well, I wish I'd done a little more homework about it. We had the civil engineering, hydraulic engineering, electrical. We had no computers or anything of that kind at the time. And we had mechanical engineering, which was divided into, we had steam and gas, and we had machine design, and we had our laboratories over in the old building. John Mack was in charge of machine design, and we had a number of different people. Torkelson was in charge of steam and gas. And I don't recall the name of the man who had charge of the shops. But that eventually led into our industrial engineering department, which is a department now.
Well, if you were all there together, sort of was what kind of cooperation was there between these different departments?
Good. That is, the steam and gas and the shops and we're all under mechanical engineering, as they are largely today. Our design section is in mechanical engineering, and then it's the power division now. They're all in under the same umbrella.
How about between mechanical engineering and, say, electrical engineering?
Well, I've observed the cooperation around here has always been top-notch. Well, there's always these little irritating things that develop, but the cooperation has been pretty good, as it is in most institutions.
Well, sometimes there are problems in this area.
Well, I think they're at a minimum around here.
Well, that's good to know.
We had a couple of very rough times over here, of course.
Well, I'd like to hear about some of those.
Well, suppose you heard about the experience we had with several of the deans, one of the deans particularly.
Well, no, I haven't. I knew that there was something because you mentioned it to me a number of years ago, that there had been such a controversy, but you never gave me the details.
Well, the details have sort of been kept under somebody's hat.
Is there any reason why they shouldn't come out now? It was a long time ago.
Well, I was just looking at some of the correspondence the other day that had to do with this Johnson regime. He almost wrecked the college engineering.
Well, I think this should be known. You understand we can restrict this for a while.
Yes, sir, we put in, I don't know how long, 2 or 3 years of pretty strenuous activities in connection with this man. There has been, I noticed in some of the university books, a story about this first faculty meeting which Johnson had over in the old building, about bringing the apples to the faculty meeting.
Well,
and telling the faculty that he was glad to see them there because next year a half of them wouldn't be there. He was going to get rid of half of the faculty.
What was his excuse for doing that? Did he have one?
This is such a complicated affair. I was traveling the state quite a lot then, and